First, a program note. The following podcast includes adult situations and language.
So you got in the car with me, and she laid back in my arm right there, and I feel the neck, and then she remembered who I was, man. She, oh, yeah, you're, and then she started laying her head back on me so I could feel it better. And God, man, all of a sudden, man, it, you know, boom, I grabbed the bitch by her neck, you know. She threw me out the door. And I held on to her neck and she fell out behind with me. Mm-hmm. Both of us fell out on the trash pile where the broken glass and cans and everything were laying on there. Mm-hmm. We fell into it, but I still had hold to her neck. And she was, so start telling on her, you know, start getting, her breath started getting short. And she started hollering, then, woo, please. And that's what happened. Yeah. I choked her to death.
That was one of the many confessions of Sam Little, an itinerant murderer who last year was named by the FBI as the most prolific serial killer in American history. Sam Little roamed the United States for 5 decades, seemingly killing at will. He's admitted to upwards of 90 murders of women, most of which have been confirmed by the FBI and law enforcement agencies from Miami to Los Angeles. As I record this, investigators in multiple states continue to piece together his violent path and clear unsolved murders with his confessions. There is a Texas Ranger whose office near Dallas has become a clearinghouse on Little and his many crimes and confessions. Profilers continue to study him in hopes of understanding why he killed. And observers and guardians of the American justice system continue to puzzle over how a murderer so prolific was somehow able to fall repeatedly through the cracks and be free to kill again and again. Little now sits in a California prison where he will be for the rest of his life. He speaks to investigators almost every week, claiming he wants to cleanse his soul of his sins. Prisoner number AV-2258 has become infamous through his crimes and confessions. He's been profiled on 60 Minutes. There are 21 pages dedicated to him on the FBI's website. In prison, he gets fan mail and frequent requests from would-be visitors. Books are being written about him, and documentaries and TV shows are being developed. But in this podcast, we are not interested in Sam Little's celebrity. We are going to tell the story behind the story, and that is primarily a story of women. The women who hunted this brutal and merciless killer down and put him in that prison cell. The women who survived his attacks and waited decades to face him down in court. And the writer who has outwitted this hater and killer of women, drawn her own confessions from him, and works to bring resolution and justice to his many victims. I'm Michael Connolly, and this is Murder Book. We are calling this season, The Women Who Stopped Sam Little.
I never made a mess out of the killings.
What a monster this guy was.
I say, this man trying to kill me, this man trying to kill me.
Okay, let's start at the beginning. And though Sam Little's life of crime goes back 50 years, for us the starting point is the morning of Sunday, August 14th, 1989, in downtown Los Angeles. East 7th Street at the time was a well-known trucking route through downtown. It was lined with bars and restaurants. For Frank Garcia, a man who made money recycling cans, Sunday mornings were a good day to go dumpster diving behind the businesses on 7th to see what he could find after the busy Saturday nights. At 8:30 a.m. that Sunday, he entered the joint parking lot behind a bar called Rossi's and a Chinese restaurant called the Canton. He flipped back the top on the trash dumpster at the rear of the parking lot to see what he could find. He didn't find any cans. What he found was a body. A woman was lying half nude in the dumpster. She was clearly dead. She would later be identified as Audrey Ellen Nelson, 35 years old. She had been strangled so viciously that during the autopsy, the medical examiner would find that her larynx was completely crushed, and there were indentations left in her neck from the rings her killer wore on his fingers. But Audrey did not die without a fight. The medical examiner also scraped skin and blood, presumably from her killer, from beneath her fingernails. There were drag marks on the body and dirt that did not match any soil from the hardscrabble area in downtown where the body had been found. It was an indication that Audrey had been killed elsewhere and then taken to the dumpster behind the bar and restaurant. An extensive canvas of the area produced no witnesses who recognized the victim or who saw elements of the crime. Police used fingerprints to identify Audrey. They learned that she had grown up on a dairy farm in upstate New York and that she had a 13-year-old daughter named Pearl, who was living on that farm and being raised by Audrey's parents. The family told detectives that Audrey had left home at a young age after a physical altercation with her mother led to her banishment. She went to New York City where she met a man who took care of her but also took advantage of her. He became her pimp. At 22 years old, she got pregnant and gave birth to Pearl. The father was unknown. When Pearl was 1 year old, she was taken from Audrey by the courts and eventually sent to the farm to be raised by her mother's family. This is Pearl Nelson.
I always was waiting for my mom. I always wanted to be with her. She was, you know, something I yearned for constantly.
Audrey eventually moved out to California, first landing in San Diego, where she ended up with a record of prostitution arrests before moving north to Los Angeles. In 1989, Pearl spent the late summer in Northern California visiting Audrey's sister, Sherry. The plan was for Audrey to come up and be reunited with her sister and her daughter after many years apart.
My mother was supposed to come, and we were going to be reunited. We wanted to get her help. You know, we wanted to help her. We were going to, you know, give her everything, and they were going to be together, like Sherry and Audrey. Like, they were going to, you know, kind of fix her life.
But Audrey never showed up for that reunion, and unknown to Pearl and her Aunt Sherry, she had been murdered. Pearl returned home to New York at the end of August, and the day after she was back, the state police showed up at the farm to deliver the bad news.
I remember being outside on the porch, and I was hand washing some of my laundry. I was hanging it up to dry, and then I remember the cop cars came. And they told me to go play, go away, you know, go take a walk or something. But I lurked. You know how we can be as kids. And I made sure I knew what was going on. I was like, I knew that this was bad. I knew it was my mother.
In L.A., there were few leads on the case, and the focus was squarely on Audrey, with detectives trying to determine her whereabouts before the murder and discover her routines and acquaintances. Her driver's license listed her address on Wilcox Avenue in Hollywood, just two blocks from the LAPD station that covered that area. But when detectives assigned to the case arrived there, they found the address belonged to a shoe repair shop. It was a dead end. They next checked field interview cards for Hollywood. These are basically 3x5 index cards that all patrol officers carry for taking down information from people they stop and question while on routine patrol. The investigators found cards indicating that Audrey Nelson was homeless and at times slept in a parking lot off of Ivar in Hollywood. The cards listed names of some of her acquaintances, and from there, the detectives went down a rabbit hole. They started following Audrey's path through the dark world of transient hotels, drug use, and prostitution in Hollywood. This was when the rock cocaine epidemic had firmly gripped Los Angeles, and it appeared that Audrey Nelson had gone down in that flood. They interviewed drug dealers and owners of flop hotels known to Audrey, but none of the work led them to a solid suspect. Then detectives got a lead from Audrey's family back on the farm in New York. The latest phone bill had arrived, and there was a record of a collect call that had come in from Audrey in Los Angeles just a few weeks before her death. The phone number led them to a rundown apartment in Hollywood and a man named Jack West. The apartment building landlord said West had just been evicted like a month earlier, but she recognized a photo of Audrey and said she used to clean West's apartment in exchange for the use of his phone and his address as a mail drop. He may have also supplied her with drugs. The landlord described West as an alcoholic with a bad temper. After West was evicted, the property he left behind was stored in the basement of the apartment building. The detectives searched it and found receipts from stays at a hotel called the Frontier in downtown L.A. It was located not far from where Audrey Nelson's body had been found. Following the first solid clue of the case, detectives went to the Frontier and learned that West was currently living there. A desk clerk and a security guard at the hotel both recognized a photo of Audrey and said she had been staying with West in recent weeks. They also questioned a hotel guest who said West told her he had caught his cleaning lady stealing from him and he beat her up. They went to West's room and knocked on the door. Then they took him in for questioning. I'm going to read here from a summary report on the West interview contained in the case's murder book. My partner and I then interviewed Jack West. He lied throughout the interview, giving conflicting statements. When asked about living companions, West stated that no one lived with him or received any mail at his address. When asked for the names of any person or persons who have cleaned up his rooms, West became very nervous. He stated that he has had several house cleaners that have worked for him, anywhere from several days to 2 weeks. We then confronted West with the name of Audrey Nelson, showing him her photograph. At first, he denied knowing her. As he became increasingly nervous, he admitted knowing her and stated she occasionally cleaned his rooms. He denied the fact that she ever lived with him and at first denied she received mail at his apartment. He also denied hanging out with the victim or ever selling drugs. He denied that the victim ever visited him at the Frontier Hotel. When told that the victim was dead, he began shaking and told us he had no knowledge of her death. West stated he had not seen the victim in 3 months. He denied ever putting his hands on the victim or telling anyone that he had. Convinced that Jack West was our suspect, we booked him at jail division for murder on September 8, 1989. The police obviously thought they had their man, and now they had 48 hours following the arrest to charge him. But the district attorney's office declined, saying the evidence was insufficient to go forward to a trial. West was released, and though the detectives on the case attempted to match rings that he wore to the markings on the victim's neck, there was nothing definitive and no charges were ever filed against West. During the investigation, the elements of the Nelson killing were entered into an LAPD computer program called Hitman, which stood for Homicide Information Tracking and Management Automation Network. They really had to work hard to get that acronym. This was an early database developed in-house and used to compare the details of local homicides, sort of a forerunner for some of the national databases now used to track murders. The inquiry on Nelson led to cases in two other divisions with similarities. One of those was the murder of Guadalupe Apodaca, whose body had been found in an abandoned auto repair shop in the Newton Division southeast of downtown. She had been strangled and left behind an old mattress that had been propped up against the wall to kind of hide her body. She was nude from the waist down. The murder occurred just 20 days after the murder of Audrey Nelson. Apodaca was 46 and the mother of a young son, but according to the murder book, she was living on the streets at the time of her killing. Like Nelson, she had a history of drug and prostitution arrests, another victim of the cycle of drugs and crime. The initial investigation of the murder narrowed down her last known location to a drug house in South L.A., where she had smoked cocaine before walking out the door and being seen getting into a van with an unknown man. From there, the trail went cold, and a meeting among detectives from Central Division, who were working the Nelson case, with their counterparts from the contiguous Newton and Rampart divisions to discuss the unsolved murders of numerous women, apparently shed no further light or direction on the case. Again, reading from the murder book. We discussed the possibility of a serial murderer strangling, then dumping female victims who were naked from the waist down. At this time, not enough similarities and consistencies exist to link these murders together. So that was it. Eventually, the murder books from the Nelson and Apodaca cases were put on shelves with other cases marked unsolved. As the years went by, the world of forensic sciences advanced with the advent of DNA. In 2001, 12 years after the murders of Nelson and Apodaca, the LAPD formed a cold case unit to take advantage of these advances in forensics.
We kind of created a criteria, and it was obviously sexually motivated cases where there was a high potential for DNA that could be found by forensic analysis.
That was Detective Rick Jackson, who you may remember from the first season of Murder Book. He was one of the original detectives assigned to the cold case unit. And at that time, there were more than 6,000 unsolved cases in the city's archives, the Nelson and Apodaca cases among them. The way it worked was that all the murder books were pulled from archives and surveyed for evidence that could be reevaluated with these new technologies.
Also cases where there was a physical altercation between the suspect and the victim, where the close contact could have resulted in there could be foreign blood, not the victim's blood that could be analyzed, things of this nature. Also, we were concerned about fingerprints because a lot of these cases came before the fingerprint databases that you could put a good fingerprint in and run it through a database now, and it would go through millions of prints nationwide that had been compiled in these databases over the years.
The initial wave of cases put together by the cold case squad primarily came out of the analysis of DNA contained in rape kits from sexually motivated murders. But in a second wave of analysis, secondary sources of DNA in cases were sought. DNA that might be on clothing or other objects found at murder scenes. DNA from under fingernails as well. It was finally during this second wave that the Nelson and Apodaca cases came down off the shelf. DNA from the two cases matched. The skin under Audrey Nelson's fingernails was a genetic match to semen found on the blouse Guadalupe Apodaca had been wearing. It was now 2012, 23 years since the murders, and finally the cases were back in play. They were given to a cold case unit detective named Mitzi Roberts. We'll meet her after this word from our sponsors. Today's episode of Murder Book is sponsored by the Hachette Book Group, which happens to be the publishers of all of my books, including the new one, The Law of Innocence. Take a listen.
From the number one New York Times bestselling author, Michael Connelly, the Lincoln Lawyer, is back. This time, Mickey Haller is taking on his toughest client ever, himself. Framed for murder, Mickey will call upon every courtroom skill he has. But a not guilty verdict won't be enough. He needs to find the real killer. That's the law of innocence. Michael Connelly can flat out tell a story, raves the Boston Globe. Pre-order the new Lincoln Lawyer novel, The Law of Innocence, available November 10th in hardcover, ebook, and audio, wherever books are sold.
And I should add here that at the end of episode 2 of Murder Book, Hachette is going to put in a sneak excerpt of the audio edition of the book, so be sure to listen for that. Now back to the podcast. So, full disclosure here. I have known Mitzi Roberts for several years. She has helped me with my books, my TV show, and in many ways my understanding of the highs and lows of detective work. It was her stories of working the midnight shift, the late show, as a rookie detective that inspired the character of Renee Ballard, who I've written about in my more recent books. I know a lot of detectives, and very few of them inspire me the way Roberts did. There was this fierceness to her, this sense of fair play and drive I wanted to capture as a writer. As a detective, as a person, she's relentless, and I wanted to get that on the page. I write about characters who live by a code that defines them, the idea that everybody counts or nobody counts. It's just basic fairness. I look for that in the people that I reach out to for help with my own work, and Mitzi Roberts is definitely one of those people. Roberts joined the LAPD 25 years ago, after spending her early 20s working in a restaurant where cops came on their breaks, talked about the job, and eventually convinced her to apply for the academy.
I remember in high school when everybody was reading Wuthering Heights, you know, I'm reading Helter Skelter and all these other true crime books because that's what fascinated me. And so when I moved out to the San Fernando Valley and I took a job in a diner and I was a waitress as I was going to school and I was like pursuing this, taking psychology classes and sort of going that direction, and these LAPD cops used to come in every morning and sit down, have breakfast, and we would talk while they were there. And they always seemed very sort of happy in their job, and they were trying to convince me to be a police officer. And I was always sort of, I've never thought about being a police officer. It never sounded something that I wanted to do, but I'm always been interested in murder and serial killers, and is that something I can do? And they said, well, that's definitely something you can do. If you become a police officer, you can definitely try and be a homicide cop and go that direction. And so it just got me thinking, like, yeah, I think I even asked them, do I get to talk to serial killers? And they said, well, potentially you would. And it's funny because now that when I first came on the job, it was like, did I really think in my career I would be talking to a serial killer? No, probably not. You know, I thought that was a long shot, but the ultimate goal was actually to work and solve murders. But now, in hindsight, it's all kind of come full circle, and here I am talking to serial killers, so.
After joining the LAPD, Roberts' ascent in the department was quick. She started off in patrol, but then moved through assignments in gang, drug, and sexual assault units, even spending a stint as a midnight shift detective before finally being promoted to the department's elite robbery homicide division, where eventually she was assigned to the cold case unit.
At 2012, for at least a year or two prior to that, we had an NIJ grant that had allotted us a ton of money for overtime and testing specifically to go through these cold cases and re-examine them for DNA and for fingerprints and stuff like that. And this was sort of the second go-around of the NIJ grant, because we had already went through those, most of the books, and now we were specifically going through the books and looking for DNA on other items like clothing and bras under fingernails, and not necessarily rape kits anymore, because we had already sort of exhausted that and the technology had gotten better and we were finding we were getting hits on other pieces of evidence.
Roberts was assigned numerous cases after her arrival in the unit, but frequently the DNA hits led to suspects who were long dead or already incarcerated for other crimes. It certainly helped clear cases and bring answers to the families of victims, but they didn't require a lot of traditional detective work. But then came April 2012, when she got a lab report on the double DNA hit that would put her on the path of a killer who was still out there somewhere and who was a threat to kill again.
When this one came along, I was really, really excited because I knew that there was something to this and that it was just going to be one of those cases that was kind of going to be like a career case. It's going to be really fun to work.
The Audrey Nelson and Guadalupe Apodaca cases were now assigned to Detective Roberts. She had a match between two victims murdered 20 days apart in areas of downtown L.A., only a few miles apart.
But I was told, you're also going to get a suspect match, but it's not coming now, it's being verified. So I knew I had these cases, and I knew I had a suspect, but they wouldn't tell me who the suspect was yet, because it had to be verified through the lab, and all the chains had to be notified and stuff before they told me.
Two murders linked by the same killer. Roberts knew she had what some detectives would call a sexy case.
What makes a case sexy is different to different detectives, too. To me, it's a case that has it's sort of intriguing and tells a story and has a mystery and there's work to do on it. I mean, some of these cold cases come in and there's not much. You're just clearing the case. I mean, it's a hit and maybe the suspect's deceased and you're just writing a report and it's just sort of paperwork. But some of these, like where there's a manhunt and there's just this long story to it, to me that's sexy. To me that's something that's really fun to work.
The lab told Roberts to stand by. The DNA samples extracted from the two cases at hand were more than two decades old, requiring more involved procedures and confirmations before a suspect could be officially named. In the meantime, Roberts didn't waste time. She pulled the murder books from the Nelson and Apodaca cases and started reviewing the cases and getting to know both their victims and their killer.
This guy's MO was so specific and rarely changed, even down to the way his victims were left, like partially clothed and stuff. So in this case, both of the victims manually strangled, left, most likely, and both of them killed in a location and then moved to a different location for the body dump. Both of them nude from their waist down. Both of them, the victimology is drug abusers, just kind of women that live on the fringes.
The cases were strikingly similar in MO. They occurred only 20 days and 2 miles apart, and yet for 23 years, they had never been connected by law enforcement. There was that one meeting of detectives back in 1989, but nothing came of it. And for all that time, the family members of the victims waited for answers. Once again, Pearl Nelson.
Oh my God, you know, every night of my life, you know, you wonder, you think about her, what, you know, we were going to be together, like having to have my own daughter and, you know, she has a black hole in her life like me. Like, you know, who's your grandmother? Who's your grandfather? Well, we don't know who he is. Well, she, you know, grandmother, you know, she was murdered. You know, it's kind of a terrible thing to live with. It's not something you share with everyone because it's not a normal story. It's torture, knowing, like, when we buried her remains, you know, I said, hi, Mom, nice to meet you. And then I had to say goodbye. And then it's like, how come they never caught who did this?
Roberts defends the original investigations, rightfully pointing out that these were not isolated murders. There were numerous murders of women in the poorest neighborhoods of the city. These were women who were just as much victims of the crack epidemic as they were the killers who took their lives. After the advent of DNA, the LAPD was able to determine that back then there were multiple serial killers preying on prostitutes and drug users in the city.
You know, in that area at that time, this was the majority of the victims.
And I was quite impressed by the job that the detectives did in Los Angeles back then. It was just, we didn't have DNA and the luxury of DNA, and this was the modus operandi of several serial killers, as you know. I mean, it was like, as we know now with DNA, we had 4 or 5 different serial killers out there at the same time, dumping bodies, using the same MO, strangling ladies, prostitutes, drug addicted women. So I just think that their workload, they were overloaded with work and didn't have the luxury of things like DNA. But I have to say with these detectives, that it seemed like they cared and they really put a lot of work into these cases. They just couldn't make it happen back then.
I can attest to that because I was a newspaper reporter in Los Angeles back at that time, and the city experienced the highest murder counts ever. It was largely fueled by the crack epidemic, gang killings related to drug turf. The collateral damage of women like Audrey Nelson and Guadalupe Apodaca were common. And I have to tell you, it got little attention in the media. It was like these people didn't count. There were too many killings, too many deaths to fit it all in the paper. I remember that my routine as the Crime Beat reporter was to gather all I could on the crimes of the day and then sit down with my editor to go through it all and decide what went in the paper. You know, if you had 3 or 4 or 5 murders in a day, it just wasn't going to go into the paper. So the reality was that in death, not everybody counted. Someone who has closely researched that grim time in LA's history and has played a key part in the Sam Little investigation is writer Jillian Lauren.
In the 80s and early 90s in South LA, it was a killing field. There were up to 6 or 7 serial killers operating at the same time, and Sam Little was one of them. Women were turning up in dumpsters, in alleys. Many of these victims had high-risk lifestyles. They were marginalized. They were drug addicts. Many times they were women of color, and they were considered less dead. They were given less consideration in their deaths.
We'll hear much more from Lauren and about her interactions with Sam Little later in the podcast. Someone who was working in those killing fields back then was now retired LAPD homicide detective Tom Lang. You might know that name from the O.J. Simpson case. But long before that, Lang was part of a secret LAPD task force attempting to stop the violence against women who dwelled on the fringes of society.
I was on it for 3 years, and my duty was I was in charge of the investigative effort in the field. We had a couple dozen Metro officers working undercover, 3 of which were female. And we were running little operations at night with the girls, putting them out there, seeing if, they could get hit on by one of these killers that we felt. Because we also realized that while there were serial killers, it was clear the MOs it probably were, but these South End prostitutes were also killed by other tricks. They were killed by pimps because they were all into drugs, so they could have been killed by the dope dealers. There was all sorts of people involved in a lot of these murders.
The task force operated from 1986 to 1988, and it resulted in more than 100 felony arrests, including the charging of 2 men with multiple killings. It was disbanded before the killings of Audrey Nelson and Guadalupe Apodaca in 89. Though Sam Little would years later confess to 5 murders in the area in 1988, Lang said that to his knowledge, Little never came up on the task force radar.
We were probably out there when he was out there. We knew that there were others, and DNA made the other suspects. And so we were on the right track, but our killers, a lot of them were probably already gone.
Let's get back to the investigation in 2012. Roberts learned all she could about her linked cases, looking at crime scene photos and the evidence stored in case archives for more than two decades. She studied photos of the victims in life and in death. All the while, she waited for the lab to confirm the identity of the man whose DNA had been left at both murder scenes. When that confirmation came, it only signaled the start of a lengthy manhunt for a killer who was in the wind. The DNA hit came back to Samuel Little, who was a 72-year-old drifter with no known address and arrest records in 24 different states, but very little jail or prison time to show for those offenses.
I started doing the due diligence in the background on Sam Little and who he was, and that took me on a whole other level of what I was dealing with and just what a monster this guy was. Like, this is way more than just the two cases that I have. But
you mean because of his criminal record?
Yeah, you get his criminal record, and then I started pulling, I'm looking for serious crimes like assaults and stuff, and I noticed that he has numerous arrests for those types of crimes, so I start pulling those crimes, if I can, all over the United States. Sometimes I would call and they would send me just the initial report and stuff, and I realized, like, this is a pattern that started with this guy from the mid to late 70s and didn't stop until, who knows, maybe even till the time he was in custody with us. I can't remember how many page wrap now, but this guy was arrested so many times for so many different things, and I think five decades, and I want to say a total of 10 years is what he did in prison, jail time, 3 days here, 3 days there combined, a total. And we're talking serious, serious assaults on women. And he's been, you know, he had been arrested for murders of women and acquitted and stuff like that. So I knew I was dealing with someone really big, someone really bad.
Detective Roberts knew who the killer was and what he was capable of. She now had to find him and get him off the street. As we'll learn in the next episode, that was a task much easier said than done. I'm Michael Connolly, and you have been listening to Murder Book. I want to thank our listeners, our sponsors, and our consultants. Murder Book is produced and edited by Terrell Lee Langford. Music is provided by Grace Kelly, including our theme song, By the Grave. Post-production services are provided by Authentic, and Emma Kikuchi is post-production supervisor. Jane Davis is in charge of our social media, and if you want to see photos and other material from the case, go to murderbookpodcast.com. Remember, subscribe to the podcast at applepodcasts.com/murderbook if you want to be alerted to new episodes and other announcements. And if you have a friend who likes true crime podcasts, make sure you tell them about this one. Finally, leave us a rating and a review at Apple Podcasts. This is Michael Connolly saying thanks for listening.